is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
This is Kip Ione, head men's basketball coach at Willamette University, founder of Teams of Men, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com, spelled A-R-Y-S-E, and use the code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off the future of performance. That's A-R-Y-S-E.com with promo code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off.
He said, man, Dave, I just want to shoot like you. You know, I want to shoot like you. He was coming through after one of Jamerson's workouts. And this is the funny line. Jamerson said to him, Steve, you're a million shots behind, dude.
T.K. Griffith has been the head boys basketball coach at Archbishop Hoban High School in Akron, Ohio, since 1993, when he was hired at his alma mater at the age of 21. Griffith has an overall record of 424 and 196 in 27 seasons as the Knights head coach. He has been named North Coast League Coach of the Year 5 times as his teams have won 7 NCL League championships since 2006. In addition, Griffith has earned honors from the Touchdown Club, the Plain Dealer, the OHSAA, and has been chosen to coach the GABCA All-Star Game multiple times. TK was a member of the 1989 Hoban State Championship basketball team as a player. He is also the host of the Teacher Coach podcast. Don't miss our Hoopheads Pod webinar series on Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. If you miss a live webinar, you can buy lifetime access to any of our previous webinars for $4.99 on the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, and our team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavalier Central, Grizz and Grind, Knuck If You Buck, the 305 Culture Miami Heat podcast, and coming soon, Blazing the Path. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Shoot an email to info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Get out your notebook right now so you can jot down some wisdom from T.K. Griffith, head boys varsity basketball coach at Archbishop Hoban High School in Akron, Ohio. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast the head boys basketball coach at Archbishop Hoban High School in Akron, Ohio, T.K. Griffith. T.K., welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it. I listen to a lot of your episodes and it's always good stuff.
Appreciate that. Thank you for the kind words. We're excited to dig in with you and learn a little bit more about your background in the game of basketball, learn how you built your program at Hoban. Want to start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Wow. Well, I grew up in Stowe, and I have to say, Stowe youth basketball was a big thing. They had junior pro basketball up at Kempton. which was a junior high. It's still Stowe's junior high, and they had the 8-foot hoops. And I believe it was funny. I always went by Kirk. Kirk was my name. My dad's name was Tim. My name was Tim. My birth name's Tim, but I always went by Kirk, my middle name. And in junior pro basketball, the coach inadvertently put T period Kirk on the back of my shirt, and that's when I kind of became TK. It was
that's
weird.
Hilarious. That's
it
funny.
It was weird because basketball kind of changed my name, I guess, literally, because my name became TK or T Kirk. But anyway, you know, junior pro basketball at Kempton was really where it kind of got started. And the guy, I wish I knew the guy's name, and I'm gonna hit myself when this is done. But for at least 20 to 25 years, he ran that program for Stowe Parks and Rec. And I can't tell you how many, and I wasn't one of them. I was just an okay player, but I can't tell you how many great players came through that system. So it started there, and then it very quickly went to CYO. And my dad, Tim Griffith, and his best friend, Tom Goodall, they both had gone to Hoban. They both were okay athletes. Tom was actually a pretty good baseball player. He actually played Division I college baseball at Akron U. My dad had a heart murmur and was born a blue baby, so he could never participate in varsity sports, but he was a decent, probably an okay athlete, I guess. But they coached me in CYO as soon as we could start CYO, which at that time I believe was fourth or fifth grade. So playing for Holy Family in Stowe was basically my upbringing in sports. And you know, you would play all sports. We played baseball. My dad coached baseball. It's in Stowe Youth Baseball League. We would play football for Holy Family, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade CYO football, where I got killed every night. I think I weighed in at like 72 pounds as a 7th grader. And we had like 7 Division I guys on our football team who ended up playing college football. And I just got murdered every night. It probably made me tougher, but I don't think I thought. I remember one time I actually tackled somebody. And the kid was like, "Hey, great tackle." And I couldn't feel either shoulder, my head, or anything. And I was like, "Wow, that's what a great tackle feels like." All right. No wonder I should do this less, not more. But, yeah, so Holy Family for sure shaped me in every way, shape, and form, growing up in Stowe.
Was basketball always number one when you were a kid, or did something else take precedence early? Just how did basketball end up being the main thing?
I mean, I grew up in the time when the seasons, you know, whatever season you were in, like my dad helped run the Stowe Youth Baseball League. So we had all the equipment at our house. And so we would put the catcher uniform on and go in the back and pitch to each other. I don't know if you guys ever made up the games in the backyard, but, you know, even if there was only two of us, we would have an imaginary batter and you know, try to strike them out and all that stuff. So if it was baseball season, I would have the baseball stuff on. Football, you know, we weren't studs as far as our physical build, but we loved football. We would play a lot of backyard football, but I always had a hoop in the driveway, and basketball was probably my first love, and I was always pretty I have good hand-eye coordination, but I'm not really all that super athletic, but I could always shoot the basketball, so that always helped me kind of find a place.
Yeah, that's a good skill to have.
Yeah.
as we know, as a player and as a coach, it's funny you were talking about playing in the backyard and inventing games. So when I was a kid, and basketball was my number one thing, but I was just like you. I played everything, especially neighborhood everything. Like I never played organized football, but I played a lot of backyard football. And I probably gave up organized baseball maybe I was 11 or 12. Whenever curveballs came in, that was the end of my baseball career. I'm like, yeah, that's right. Enough. But I used to play backyard baseball with a buddy of mine, just one-on-one, yeah. You know, taking the ball, throwing it up and hitting it. We had like a neighbor's yard in our backyard that their garage, yeah, kind of backed up to the back of our yard. And so that, right, was, if you hit it over the garage, that was a home run. Yeah. And I used to be the 1979 Baltimore Orioles. That was my team. So I would go through, you know, we'd go through the lineups, and, you know, I'd be John Lowenstein and, oh, yeah, you know, all these, yeah, guys, Eddie Cal Murray. Ripken. And yeah,
who was their pitcher? Who was the great pitcher they had?
They had Jim Palmer.
Yeah, and Jim Palmer. I had his baseball card. I loved Jim Palmer.
Mike Flanagan. Yeah. I think they had Tippy and Dennis Martinez. It's crazy, oh, yeah, that I can remember this from, right, whatever it is now, 40 right, years ago. But
yeah,
nonetheless, I think when you're a kid, and it's one of the things that I always feel bad for my kids, and I've said this before on the podcast, that I think, right, kids miss out on just that ability to kind of hang in the neighborhood and be inventive, yep, because, yeah, we as parents and coaches, and again, there's a lot of positive to the situation, sure, now, sure, but I think kids do miss out on that, yeah, creative aspect of sports that you and I and Jason even although he's kind of at the tail end right. of our generation.
Yeah.
You know, you miss out on those things as kids. I feel bad for this generation that they don't get to experience that.
Wait, you're looping me in with your generation, Mike? Hold on a second.
Well, I mean, I know I'm saying
I'm 33 years old. Come on,
I'm saying but you always talk about how you right. how you played outside a little bit.
And yeah, today's I'm just giving you a hard time.
I know today's kids don't play outside at all. So
no, they don't. It was a whole different world. One fun memory was. The Terzola family who lived up the street, we actually made our own wiffle ball field with dugouts and everything. We had a green monster in right, which was his house. We had a fence that was already there in left field. But we actually built dugouts and stuff one year and had our own like wiffle ball kind of stadium up at his house. And the end of that story is his children are now at Hoban, and they're really, really good baseball players. In fact, his son smacked a double against St. V's and scored a couple runs. And I felt like I had something to do with it somehow, just because, you know, we experienced all that together. And yeah, we would say, you know, after that, you know, I don't know if you guys remember playing war or guns at night.
Oh yeah.
I mean, we would, and now you'd get killed if you did it. Somebody would probably just shoot you in the backyard. But I mean, we were in people's backyards at, you know, 10, 11 at night, you know, playing what we called war. You know, I don't know what it was, but we just called it war. So yeah, that creative part's gone.
Yeah, it's amazing. The amount of time that I spent like in trees and on people's garage roofs
exactly.
and running through creeks and going right. underneath culverts and all these yeah. things that, you know, now you look at and my kids will go out on the driveway and sometimes right. be like, hey, are you out there by yourself? You know, it's just, it's amazing how different things are. And I think, you know, that does, when we talk about it from a basketball standpoint, I think it does have an impact. And I think the one thing that I always say that I feel like kids today miss out on is because you only play as you're coming up with kids your own age and in a gym with officials and your parents in the stands. I think that there's some creativity that's lost. And conversely, right. on the other side, I do think that there's a lot better coaching for the most part in terms of teaching kids the technical skills of the game and giving them opportunities
right.
than there was when you and I were kids. I mean, I didn't get exposed probably to really good coaching from a technical aspect till for sure high school. And then I know I got to college at Kent and that was the first time I had ever heard the term closeout. And so now you yeah. think about like my son right. was in third grade, my daughters were in third grade and they right. were already hearing all this stuff and beginning yep. to learn it. And so there's a trade-off between the two systems. But again, as an old school guy, I miss the system that I grew up in playing on the playgrounds and not spending yeah. so much time playing travel right. basketball and AAU. I miss the playground.
Yeah, one thing that was kind of fun for me, once I went to Hoban, I did make the freshman team, which was a huge accomplishment for me because we had a lot of talent up there. But then sophomore year, I actually got cut at Hoban. So I was bound and determined to make it the next year, which I ended up doing. But I would get up in the morning and, you know, throw some ankle weights on at 5:30 and try to run 2 miles, which I thought was going to make me faster. Actually, come to find out, that just makes you slower.
Right.
But anyways, the point of the matter was then at night I would go up to Lakeview High School in Stowe, and kids would pull their car up. They had courts over by the football field over there, and there were just incredible games with older guys over there. And that's where I really learned how to compete. Like occasionally Jamerson or Bill Sellers or some of those big names would show up. A lot of times it was just more younger guys, but that was always neat. And if you got picked or if you did something good, you know, you felt really proud if you were on a team of older guys and you made a couple shots or you got a steal.
Absolutely.
You know, you kind of earned your keep out there a little bit, and maybe next time they knew who you were.
And you had to learn how to play your role.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was an experience that I don't think kids get anymore either.
Was Mr. Jamerson ever there on the courts?
Yes, absolutely. Well, we would go to Lions and Oakwood in the falls, and that's where he would be. He was always
gotcha.
At either Lions or Oakwood or Valley Vista. So, yeah, yeah, he was still shooting it well into his 50s or 60s.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. I used to play yeah. with him up at the gym in Kent during the off season when we weren't in season. And,
yeah.
you know, that guy could shoot it. And he definitely there was something to be said for the shooting gene that he passed on to Dave.
Oh,
no question.
Gosh.
I got to have a few of his shots put in my face during my college career. So I've never played against anybody who shot the ball as well, being well defended
right.
as he did. I think the one game, I'm trying to think what his total was. Man, I want to say he had like 52 against me. And I seriously feel like he might have made only like two or three shots where I wasn't, you know, or against any normal mortal person. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I would have been right there. And he was just, I mean, he was just bombing from everywhere. And I think about him in the context of like, what would he be like in today's game? Where, yeah. I mean, he had free reign to launch back then, but clearly the game was so much different.
Yep,
and if he played today, and you know, clearly his injuries cut short his pro career, but he was as good of a shooter as I've ever been on the floor with, for sure.
Yeah. He had a famous line that I always use because a good friend of mine, Steve Barnes, who went to OU for a couple of years, his daughter Soleil Barnes played basketball with my daughter in AAU. So I coached Soleil for a couple of years. And
Steve played with me in the Cleveland Pro-Am for a couple of years.
Oh, okay. So you know Steve? Real good guy. And he told me that when he was down at OU playing ball for a year or two with Dave that you're a million shots behind. And I think there's so much truth to that.
That's awesome.
You're a million shots behind. I mean, that's what makes you great, right?
It is. I mean, there's no doubt.
The only guy I've ever had a guard for like two possessions out right when he retired in 2013, Earl Boykins was playing in the Strongsville Rec Basketball League. And for some reason, I had to draw him for two possessions. And then I said, I'm not guarding him anymore. Someone else take him, please. I think he scored 66 in that game, pretty sure.
That sounds about right.
That is a special challenge there. His quickness was unbelievable.
I would definitely say that I'm not quick.
I would say that,
Jay. Because I played against Earl, I think once or twice in the Lakewood Y League. And there's two things I remember about it. Is one is just even if you try to stay in front of him, which is nearly impossible, but basically you're just backpedaling the whole time. And then he can be going 90 million miles an hour and just stop. Right. And so even if you are still in front of him, you're still going backwards by the time he's already shot the ball. And then the other thing I remember about him is, and this is something that I don't think I ever really learned about myself as a player until I don't even remember how old I was. At that point, I was probably 27, 28. I don't know, just playing kind of in the men's league circuit.
Right.
And I remember him yelling at his teammates when they were playing against me, make him go to his right. And I mean, I'm a right-handed player. And he would say, make him go to his right. And I had never had anybody said that. And then I started kind of looking at, why is he telling everybody to force me to the right? And then I kind of self-evaluate. I'm like, yeah, I do feel a lot more comfortable putting the ball on the floor with my left hand
and shooting
going that direction and kind of getting to the basket. And it was more natural for me for whatever reason.
Right.
But I had never in my entire playing career had I ever had anybody say that to me or about me, which again speaks to his basketball intelligence.
Well, there you go, Mike. We finally have someone in common that we guarded at some point in our lives.
There you go. It's like the connection to isn't there still a connection of guys who have played with Shaq that are still making it to the NBA finals? So there's some thread of connection here.
Listen, I think the only team that has a shot at this year is the Lakers, right? I think it might end if LeBron doesn't get it.
If LeBron doesn't win the title or get to the finals, then that could be it. But it is what it is.
It's funny you said that, Mike, because I've always felt like a right-handed shooter shoots it better off the bounce to the left because he can gather the ball from his left hand to his right hand.
Yep.
Whereas when you're going right, you can't really gather the ball. There's something about that. I don't know what it is kinesthetically, but there's something there.
I agree. And then I was always – it's funny because I used to go and, I obviously had a pretty decent left hand, but I would love to go to my left and then kind of turn my body to protect because I was never what you would call a jumper. So I had to be able to protect the ball when I was going up. So I'd like to go in with my right hand and kind of turn my body into the defender. But again, that was not anything that I was consciously aware of until, again, long after my real playing career was over and I was just playing in some rec league. So it's interesting what you learn about yourself over time.
Yep.
I need to cycle back, Mike. Udonis Haslem also played with him, so he's still technically a Miami Heat. So there you go.
All right, so we got two guys. Good work. Nice job, Ryan Crack research staff there. Good job, Jason. All right, so talk to me a little bit about your high school experience. Just what – give me one or two memories that stick out for you as a high school basketball player.
Yeah. The big thing was, I'm someone who got cut. So it makes it, I don't want to say it makes making cuts, even that much more sensitive, although I've been doing this for 28 years now. So it gets less sensitive as you go on. But you do feel for those guys because basketball was really all I had. My mom and dad, you know, did not live together and were divorced, you know, and basketball, I don't want to say it was all I had. I had a good family, but basketball was my main thing. So when that's taken away from you, that's something that always sticks with me. So I guess one thing personally that maybe I'm proud of is coming back and making the team, and then ironically 2 years later being part of a state championship team. So my senior year at Hoban, which would without a doubt was my best memory, we won the state championship in Division III down at St. John's Arena. And we were a team that was 12-0, then lost 7 of our next 8, which is crazy. Had a kid quit the team, maybe a couple other things happened, some drama behind the scenes that I probably didn't know about as a kid. And then we went on a 7-game winning streak and won the state championship. So, you know, without a doubt, being a part of that group, feeling like I contributed in practice more so than in games. Although this is kind of funny. I was kind of a role player. I didn't get to play a whole lot, guys. So I don't want to act like I was a star. I've listened to your podcast, Mike, and I know you played for Coach Groove and Coach McDonald. And, you know, I know you played college basketball. I wasn't that type. But
I didn't even make the team, so ahead of me, so you're good.
But in the state championship game, we're down 3 in double overtime, and the coach threw me in, and that was my first action. And I actually caught the ball on the left wing. And luckily I was smart enough to shot fake and give it up to a better player who made the 3, and we went into another overtime and then won.
Nice.
But it was kind of cool to have a small part of that. But then throughout the season, you know, there was other stuff that happened that was good, both individually and team wise, but more importantly, the relationships and just the memories. So without a doubt, winning the state championship was my fondest memory.
How much do you miss St. John Arena as the site for the high school championships?
I've always been crushed that they don't have it at St. John. To me, they should have never left St. John's Arena. That is the only place that the state championship should be played, in my opinion. I mean, it's not even close. I don't like the shot. It's just way too spaced out. People aren't on top of each other. I mean, I'd rather have it at Canton McKinley Fieldhouse than the shot and just sell 5,000 tickets. But no, St. John's Arena is by far. And I had the pleasure of coaching a Final Four there in 98. And so I got to experience, and that was the last year that they were ever at St. John's. So I always felt like, God gave me a nice gift there by allowing me to have a chance to coach a Final Four game there.
Yeah, to me, I mean, it's a perfect college venue. And I know why, with the corporate boxes and all the things that modern arenas have that St. John Arena didn't have.
Right.
But still, you go down there for an Ohio State game, you put 13,000 people in there, or as you said, you go in there for a state championship high school game, and you pack everybody, students and fans, right around the floor, and with the balconies hanging over, and just, again, it felt like Ohio State basketball. It felt like high school basketball, and it just, there's not the same feeling when you go into the shot.
It's all straight up. I mean, the only place it reminds me of is Hinkle Fieldhouse at Butler.
Right.
My daughter lives in Indianapolis, and I finally got a chance to go into that arena, man, and I actually kind of cried. I had some tears. That was to me that's kind of like a chapel or a church as much as it is. You know, I didn't realize John Wooden played like one of the first games ever played there in a state championship game. I mean, right when it was built. I mean, think about that history.
It's crazy.
And the score was like 12-8, and he had like 7 points or something. The final score was like, I don't know, something like 16-5 or 12-8. But just think about that place being packed with John Wooden playing in a high school game.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is. The history of the game and just the connection between, like we always say, that ball just is, it's incredible how it connects people and just the history and everything that goes along with that. It's amazing when you look at how interconnected people are and how one person that knows this person that knows that person, and you can be quickly connected to just about anybody in the basketball world through just a couple people. It's always incredible to me. And I find whenever we're doing the interviews that you talk to people that you have no idea prior to talking to them that they had a connection to this person, or they knew this person, or this person helped get them their start.
Right.
And that's what's amazing to me is just the stories that people tell. So along those lines, when did you start thinking about coaching and teaching as a profession? Was that something that you kind of always had in the back of your head, or was it something that sort of grew on you over time? How did coaching and teaching get on your radar as a career?
Yeah. You know, it's weird. I went to St. Edward's University where my mom and dad had gone to college. I'm sorry. My dad was from Hoban too, and he met my mom down in Texas. So we kind of continued the family tradition. I was the oldest brother to go. But when I went down there, I was clueless. I mean, I guess I feel like that was the day where when you went to college, at least in my family, nobody told you what to major in, and they didn't. Like, I just went to college. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I majored in English writing and business just because I was pretty good in English class, and I thought I'd throw business in there so I could maybe somehow get a job. But, I mean, I was clueless. And I would sit in class sometimes, I'm embarrassed to say this, and draw flag football plays up because we had a pretty good intramural flag football team. And I just love the X's and O's of stuff. You know, I've always been into the X's and O's of stuff. So I kind of knew right away. I was the dorm rector for the basketball team. And I had tried out for the team, but St. Ed's was one of those NAIA schools. They got a ton of Big 12 transfers. So we had like a 7'2 kid from Africa who was at UT for a year. We had three kids from Tech. You know, we had some studs. And I wasn't going to fit that athletically. So I did go to a couple tryouts, and it never really worked out, you know. But being a part of the dorm and being the hall rector for the basketball team, even in the second semester of my freshman year, kind of got me a little bit closer to it. And then I immediately, probably that spring, went to a local high school, St. Michael's Academy, and asked them if I could start helping out. So from my sophomore year to my senior year, I was their freshman coach, then their JV coach. And then by the time St. Edwards was done, our U-Haul, my wife and I went down there together. We were kind of dating. And we had our U-Haul packed to come back to Kent State to go to my master's program. My mom was a professor at Kent State, so I could go there for free to get the master's at teaching. And anyways, the U-Haul was packed. We were about to leave the next morning. My friends had a goodbye kind of little get-together for me. And St. Michael's called and offered me their head coaching job. So I had like 3 hours to make my decision. And that was a horrible night because I really wanted to stay because basketball is all I cared about. But we because we were in the program was going to be free for me too, so it was hard to pass it up. And Amy was on the program too, coming back here, my wife at Kent State. So we just made the choice that I guess we'll just go back home. And then lo and behold, 3 weeks later, it's a long story, but I'll cut to the chase. I ended up getting the Hoban job kind of by default because my dad kept pushing me. He kept saying, you know, Hoban can't find a coach. I mean, maybe you should call him. I said, Dad, they're not going to hire me. I mean, I had applied for the freshman job, but I said, they're not going to hire me. I'm 21 years old. He goes, just give them a call. So I called, and they said, thanks, but no thanks. And then about 2 or 3 weeks later, they said, hey, why don't you come in for an interview? You know, we still haven't found the coach. We have about 5 people coming in that day. We'll squeeze you in. And the interview went great. And, you know, 7 people who were a huge part of the Hoban family were on the interviewing committee, and I got the job when I was 21. It kind of got it by default because at the Catholic schools, as you guys probably know, it's a little bit hard to find somebody who wants to give up their public school salary, you know, to go teach and coach at Hoban, and they really wanted somebody in the building.
Yeah, being in the building, I think, is so important. I think that's one of the challenges that, you know, you see around today. There were a lot of coaches aren't in the building, whether they're just hired out because they're not teaching, or maybe they teach at a different school or in a different system. And you see that a lot more frequently, I think, than you did 20 or 30 years ago, just because of the shortage of good coaches that are out there. So I think there's definitely a huge advantage to being in the building. We could talk about that a little bit as we get into it a little bit more. I want to go back to kind of your decision to pursue high school coaching. When you were at St. Edwards, did you ever think about trying to volunteer? So when you went to St. Michael's, did you ever think before doing that about trying to get involved with the college coaching at that time?
Oh yeah, absolutely. In fact, I went up and met with Jamie Campaglio at the University of Texas, and I was so scared. I never forget. Tom Penders was the head coach at UT. Jamie Campaglio was the assistant, and I went up and I kind of pretended it was for a school project if I could interview him, but I really wanted to kind of know what could I do to get into college coaching, and you know, could you help me? He was intimidating. If you remember, he's the guy that ended up getting fired for the per diem stuff.
I don't know
if you remember that. He had a nickname. He was called like the Golden Arm or something like that. He was a really good shooter at Weber State or Wagner State. I can't remember one of those two. He's a pretty well-known guy in the coaching ranks, and he ended up getting let go. Something happened with per diems down there. But he was intimidating, and it didn't really go anywhere. That I thought maybe it could. I mean, I would go and watch their practices at least 3 times a week. They would let me in. So I kind of got to know them, but I never got to know them well enough. And I wish I would have been a better networker back then, because I was a little afraid to make that next step, you know. And St. Michael's was more comfortable and easier for me to get into. But I would go back and work the Metro Index camp. You know who was really nice to me was Coach Grube and his assistant, Chris Davis.
Yep. Chris is a great guy. Chris was there for, I think he was there my three. He was not there my freshman year because Jay Smith, who ended up going to up to Michigan, and then was the head coach at Central Michigan. Jay left after my freshman year. Right. And then Coach Davis came in when I was a sophomore.
Yeah. Yeah. So he I'm one of those guys. I wrote letters to every camp in the country. You know, Dan Dockich at Indiana, I was trying to work that camp. I kind of got a hold letter there because a lot of people wanted to work that camp. But Chris Davis kind of hooked me up with the guy that runs Metro Index, who I think his name was Butler. And I can't remember his first name right now. Joe Butler, I'm pretty sure, ran Metro Index. And so I would go down there and work 2 or 3 weeks of Metro Index camp. Then I would work the Kent State camp, and Coach Grube really took us in. I mean, we went to his house just because we worked camp. We went to his house at least 2 or 3 times for like an end of the camp week party and stuff like that for several years. So he could not have been any nicer to me. And Chris Davis was great. And then I would work other camps, Coleman Crawford's Akron U camp. You know, I'm like the young coach that they would have stretch out everybody. And the funny thing is I'm not limber at all. and so, you know, you have 300 kids in front of you and you're doing like the leg touches. And I'm like, holy crap.
That's funny.
And, you know, they take the coaches out the night before too. So you're feeling a little groggy there at 6 a.m. stretching all the campers. And you're not that flexible to begin with. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot from all that. And, you know, it put you out there in front of people where you had to lead. But I've always had the dream of being a college coach. And that's always really what I wanted to do. I just kind of fell into the high school thing and then started having a family. And it kind of just worked out where that's where I've been.
Yeah, I think when you look at and you compare the lifestyle of a high school coach versus a college coach, I think you can engineer your life at least a little bit easier as a high school coach in terms of the responsibilities that you have for being on the job and, you know, the recruiting piece of it and just the year-round nature. Although, as you well know, the year-round nature of high school basketball coaching, right, probably since you started compared to where we are now, the amount of time that's required has increased dramatically just to be on,
right,
just to be average. Yep. The amount of time that you have to put in is huge. And certainly if you want to be exceptional, it's gone.
Right.
Even more so the other way.
Right.
And yeah, working camps, I think that's one of the things that struck me that you talked about there was just thinking about networking. And I think about myself when I was younger. And again, I started out and got my first job coaching. When I first got done with school at Kent, I went back to Cleveland State to get my master's in teaching. I had a similar situation to you. My dad was a professor at Cleveland State. So I got to go and get my master's for free. And that's how I got my teaching certificate, because I had a business degree from Kent. And kind of looked around after I graduated. And I was like, well, you want me to go to work in July and put on a suit? I'm like, and both my parents were in education, so I'd never really seen anybody do that. So it was really a foreign concept to me. So I'm like, maybe I'll go back to school and, you know, become a teacher and become a coach. And so that's what I decided to do. And then my first job was with Rich Voyers out at Bay Village. I was the JV coach out there for 2 years. Mm-hmm. But at that point, I kind of, you know, came off my playing career. Really had no idea what I was doing as a coach. The only thing I knew was what my high school coach had done and what we had done at Kent. And so that was what I based – everything that I did was based off of those two experiences.
Right.
And I think back on it now and I'm like, God, I know looking back on it, I wasn't very good. But the more I know and think about it, the more I'm like, God, I must have been terrible because I didn't
– I think the same, yeah.
You know, I didn't study. I didn't go to – I mean, I didn't even go to clinics. I didn't network. I didn't do – I wasn't – watching film. I wasn't trying to figure out. I was just like, well, this is what I know. This is what worked for me. I was a good player. I'm probably a good coach. And here we go. And it's one of the things that if I look back on it, I'm like, I really regret that I didn't take advantage more of the networks that I had. And even like you talking about Coach Grube and Coach Davis. And I recently reconnected with Coach Grube and Coach Smith and Coach McDonald, who probably collectively, the three of them, I mean, I don't think I've talked to them for 25 years.
Right.
And it was great to be able to reconnect with them. But those are relationships that, you know, you wish you would have cultivated more as a young person.
Absolutely.
As opposed to just waiting, as opposed to waiting till you're 50 years old to cultivate those relationships.
Yeah. And that's something. I was the oldest in the family. And I feel like my younger brothers, when you grow up in the house and you're the younger one, you kind of see your older brothers or sisters and you mature a little bit faster as far as your networking skills. I worked my butt off, but I could have been a better politicker. Let's put it that way. And I grew into becoming pretty good at that, but that's a skill I wish I would have. I wish I could have taken advantage of that more if I really wanted to get into the college ranks. But like I said, things worked out and we started having a family, and Hoban soon became a home. So,
all right. So talk about being a head coach at 21. First of all, what's it like coaching as a 21-year-old? And you clearly had experience from coaching the JVs where you were very close in age
right.
to the kids that you were coaching. So talk a little bit about what were the challenges of that? And then I think there's probably some benefit to it as well in the fact that you can more closely relate to kind of what they're going through. So maybe just talk about what that first year experience was like in terms of what was good, what was bad about it.
Right. First of all, you have to figure out who you are. I mean, you're still a kid when you're 21 or 22, but I had to play as if I was an adult, which I did have to grow up a little bit faster. Like I said, my parents were together. I kind of helped raise my younger brothers a little bit. So in a way, I worked a lot of jobs, paid for my own college tuition, you know what I mean? Stuff like that. So I was a little bit ahead of the curve as far as my maturity. And we got married when I was 22. So, I mean, we were, you know, I wasn't going out every night, you know, and being a kid in that way. So that helped a little bit. However, I was clueless in what I was doing as far as coaching. I mean, I thought I had a clue, but when I look back at it, I'll never forget the assistant principal said something to me like, it was my second or third game, and he was like, hey, you know, what's this team look like tonight? You know, did you, you know, what's your scouting report looking like? And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I have no idea. Like, I didn't scout them. My first year, we would go
we're
out.
We're just coming out to play, man. Ready.
Yeah, I mean, we would go out and maybe scout a few teams if we could, and we knew that was a part of it, but I didn't realize it was such an important part of it. Let's put it that way. So I don't want to say we didn't scout at all, because that would be horrible. I'd hate for my players who played back then to go, what, you never scouted? But I guarantee you the first half of that season, I don't think we scouted much at all. We just went out and played, which is kind of funny because when I've talked to Jack Grenells Jr. about his dad's teams, he said his dad never scouted. He said he could care less what the opponent did. You know, it was, this is Barberton basketball. This is how we're going to play. You adjust, you know. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe I was on to something.
I'll do that just like a Hall of Fame coach,
right? Yeah. But that's not why I did it. So I'm just saying that there's more than one way to skin a cat. But I certainly scout the heck out of everybody now and am very, very prepared for every game. But I think the most important factor at that age was I wasn't sure who I wanted to be in my – my biggest influence growing up as far as high school influences was a football coach at Hoban named Coach Kara Boulad, who was like an incredible speaker, a great motivator, very impromptu talker who could get the whole place fired up. And he loved classical music. He loved rock music. He would play songs and give talks about songs. And I just kind of showed up and I thought I was going to be him. So like before our first game, you know, I had the guys huddle up in this little closet and I played some Pink Floyd song. And these guys are looking at me like, who the hell is this kid? You know, and what does this have to do with our game tonight? You know, so I was trying to figure out who I wanted to be. I was probably trying to be like other people. And it takes a while to settle into who you are and what you're good at. So I guess that would be, you know. And the good news is I was willing to work hard. I was willing to have camps and stuff. And we weren't that good for 2 or 3 years, but they had patience with me. And then we were able to turn the corner like in year 4 and 5.
How long did it take before you felt comfortable in your own skin of, I'm not just imitating or doing the things that I've seen other people do, but maybe I've taken those things and now I've made them my own? At what point did you feel like you settled in? It has nothing to do with your one loss record, but just when did you settle into the job and feel like,
right,
hey, I'm doing a good job. We may be 10-10 this year, or we may be 19-1, but right, but I know what I'm doing at this point.
Yeah, I've never settled in.
That's a good answer, TK. I like it.
I still don't feel good about. I mean, people don't understand when you're the head coach. You know, there's a lot of insecurity involved in it, man. You're going out there like, holy crap, we're going to get our ass kicked tonight. I mean, these guys are so much better than us. You know, you know, these are some of your internal thoughts, and you're in charge of it. You know, it's a whole different ball of wax when you're the guy that's in charge of it. And when it doesn't go well and the team looks bad, man, everybody, you know, even if they don't really care and it's high school basketball and they go home and don't think about it, you think they do. So I don't think if you ever get comfortable in that chair, then maybe it's time to get out. So I've never gotten comfortable. But I feel, I mean, I bet I've coached, because I coached my own kids in CYO for about 16 years. I coached CYO after, like, I would go from my high school practice to my kids' practice and I would coach their team. I was their head coach. And then I would go right to AAU for about 16 years. I coached their AAU teams too. So if I think about the amount of games I've coached, I probably have coached, you know, I don't know, 5,000 basketball games. So I feel more comfortable with the rhythm of a game and knowing how to make some adjustments. And I feel comfortable not having to control the game. You know, I know you kind of know after a while that you can't control everything, but you can see it. And you can have you know what's going on, but you might not be able to change it. You know, you see a game and you're reminded, oh, crap, we didn't work on boxing out as much as I wanted to this week, and we're getting our butt kicked on. You know what the problem is, but you can't always fix it right then. So that's where I feel more comfortable in understanding the game and understanding where our strengths and weaknesses lie. But it doesn't mean that you're ever ready or you ever have the time to be ready with your team, because there's always something that you're focusing on that maybe – which leaves something else that you're not good at. You know, we're a great transition team. But now we're playing the Green Bulldogs, and they're playing phenomenal three-point line and in D, and they're not letting us run, you know. And they're not giving us those lanes that somebody else is. So now we have to adjust, you know. So I like problem solving and adjusting, but I don't think I ever really feel comfortable. There's always that nervousness.
All right. So two things I want to ask you. I'll go to the first one, and then I'll come back to. I have a parenting question for you, but
yeah.
I want to talk about what you just said in terms of making adjustments and figuring out what it is that you need to focus on. So when you look at trying to build your team year in and year out, how do you go about figuring out what the focus is going to be for your season? What's the focus going to be for a particular practice? What's the focus going to be for a particular game? How do you go about just planning out
yeah.
what you're going to do? Are you looking at personnel? Are you looking at opponent? Are you looking at these are the things that we've done in the past? How do you go about figuring out right. what you're going to emphasize day to day? What's going to be important to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, other than this summer, summer basketball is huge for me because it gives me an opportunity to try a lot of different combinations. And I always get a really good feel of our team because we go hard in the summer, like in June and part of July, then I let them go. You know, we're in a bunch of summer leagues, and basically Monday through Thursday, we're in a league every night, or we're doing something. So that gives me a month to experiment with our new combinations, our new personalities, our you know. And Hoban's a weird, you know, we're kind of a weird private school in the basketball area, at least in that, you know, we're not St. V's and we're not Ed's or Ignatius, where I'm not getting the best, you know, five kids from the area. We might get one of those, but then I'm getting a lot of CYO kids. I'm getting a couple random kids from who knows where, maybe Kent, maybe, I don't know, maybe Medina, maybe there's a kid from Coventry who, you know, you're getting some random kids who have never played together. So our chemistry is always really hard to develop. It's not hard to develop, but it's the key to develop some chemistry. So, I'm a procrastinator too, but I use the summer to kind of figure out what I want to do. And then that first month of the season, we're going to do a lot of decision-making things. We're going to do a lot of scenarios in practice where I can kind of figure out what we're good at. And then for the first part of the season, like December, I'll go with what my gut instinct is on what I think we need to do. And then I'll kind of reassess around January and make some final decisions by February 1st. But I'm not afraid to change to win a game. We're not Stowe and we're not Green in the fact that I don't have homogenous parts. I don't have guys who are going to screen the heck out of you like a Stowe Bulldog, who's a 6'4" football guy, you know, who can bench 380. You know what I mean? I don't have guys like that, and we're not homogenous. So we can't. I guess we could. Maybe a different coach could, but we don't do the same thing every game, and that's a strength and that's a weakness. So we're not going to just play pack line defense on D and just run whatever flex on offense. You know, we're going to be a little adaptable, and I think our adaptability over the years has helped, but I also think it's hurt. And if I can critique myself, it's probably something that I wish we could just stick with something a little bit more. But I'm not afraid to adapt, and I think it can get us a couple nice upsets. But perhaps we need to do it less so that we can be a little bit better at what we do. If I had to self-assess where we are,
so how do you figure out what those things are that you're going to do. In other words, if you're going to be adaptable within the course of a game and you say, okay, well, if this is what the opponent throws at us, we're going to do this. Where do those come from? Where do those ideas come from? Where do you go to learn?
Right.
And then how do you go about making sure that your players are at least somewhat prepared for that ability to adapt? Because we all know that trying to draw something up in 1 minute during a timeout with high school kids isn't always successful. So you got to have at least something in there that allows them to adapt. So how do you do that?
We always, I don't want to say we always, because again, I'm not an always type of guy, but we generally speaking, we'll put a plan A and a plan B on the board before the game. And sometimes a C. we'll have A, B, and C, you know, and the kids will know, you know, guys, this is our plan. We want to stick with this. Let me just make something up. We don't run diamond press, but let me just act like we do. If plan A is we're going to diamond press back into our man-to-man and we're not going to let 12 catch the ball, you know, okay, let's just say it's 20-10 after the first quarter. Okay, well, guess what? That's not working. So maybe plan B is to get into a little, you know, a little half court, maybe trap, something that we've practiced. We're never going to do anything we haven't practiced. I mean, this is something that we have in our package that we do all year. And that's how we're going to adjust. And then if that's not working, okay, maybe we're just going to go full court run and jump and just throw everything but the kitchen sink at them and see if we can get back in this game. You know, offensively, you know, we might mix in dribble drive, ball screen motion, or maybe more of a passing and screening motion, depending on what kind of team you are. You know, if you're a team that we can blow by, we're just going to go dribble drive, which is, I like, to me, that's wishbone offense. You know, wishbone offense in football is here we are, we're coming at you. You know, dribble drive to me is here we are, we're coming at you. You can't guard us. When you slide over to help, we're going to make the pass that's going to beat you. So dribble drive could be plan A, perhaps 1 year, maybe ball screen motion could be plan B, and maybe plan C could be a couple sets or maybe like a motion offense that's more cutting and screening and reading.
All right, let's break it down a little further and talk about you're into the season and you're putting together a practice. What does your practice planning look like for you? When are you doing it? How long are you doing it? When do you incorporate your staff into it? Just talk a little bit about the process of putting together a practice plan in season.
Yeah, during the season, well, first of all, I'm the head of the English department at Hope, and so I teach all the honors classes on the sophomore and junior level, and I also teach the school newspaper, so I'm pretty busy during the day, but they usually give me the last period free. We get 5 minutes between classes, and I get a 25-minute lunch, so any five-minute period I have.
There you are.
Yeah,
right?
And I don't eat lunch in the faculty lounge. I stay in my room. I have to work all day to get this stuff done. So long story short, during those 5 minute increments, which might be five of them, so that's 25 minutes. And then during my lunch and then during my free period, I'm doing everything I can to get ready. And my practice schedules, I have every practice schedule I've ever written since like, I think, maybe 01 on my computer. I save everything. And so sometimes I'll go back to the previous years to see what we did. But generally speaking, I like to create a new one each day. I don't like to really look at the past. So I'll kind of know what we need to do. I've got like 10 to 20 defensive things that maybe I know are good go-tos. We have a cutthroat thing that's very, very competitive where we're running some of our half-court sets against a D for punishment or for reward, however you want to look at that. We've got some transition kind of chaos things that we do. That are advantage, disadvantage, you know, playing in chaos. We call it Hilltopper. It's JV versus varsity, and it's just mass chaos. There's no out of bounds, and it's the whole game of basketball. To try to explain it might be complicated, but let's just call it like a 4-on-3 with a guy chasing in, but it's continuous. And there's teams on each side, and you know, you get scored on different things. When we're playing the Hilltopper game, which is a time 10-minute game, not only are we keeping score, but the varsity always starts down 20-0. So the varsity scores down 20 points. A, they have to win it, so they have to come back down 20. Secondly, we then as a team, so JV and varsity, we're playing for certain identity points. So let's say identities are deflections, charges, great box outs, and hustle plays. If we get 20 of those, then we don't have to run. You know, so. That's a part of like our DNA of what we want to do, generally speaking, in most years. And then I'm really, really big on preparing for the opponent. If I know the opponent, and I will, you know, I'm not, hopefully I'm doing the same thing everybody else is, but I'm assuming everybody does this, but I'll know my opponent inside and out, and I'll know everything that you're going to do on offense, and we'll be ready for it. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to execute that, right. But I mean, I'll know every set you run, and we will have an answer for it. Now, I will say this, some of the guys and some of my assistants have critiqued that maybe we do it too much. But I just like to be ready. So if you're running a set where maybe you go 1-4 high and you enter to the right, we may trap that first pass. We're either going to blow it up. We're either going to blow up your set or we're just going to stop it. So if we blow it up, we're going to trap that first stop, that first pass. If we just want to stop it, we're not going to do anything crazy like trap it. We're just going to know how to guard it. And so our kids will know kind of, you know, are we blowing this up, coach, or are we just going to stop it? And so we'll go over everything the opponent does, and then we'll also get ready for any wrinkles that they might do defensively. You know, if we're playing St. Ed's, you know, and they sometimes play that 2-2-1 or that 2-1-2, I want to make sure that we're very comfortable with how we're going to break that, what we're looking to get out of it. You know what I mean? And then I have a whole segment for special teams. I want to make sure, to me, one of the worst things you could do is lose the game on special teams. So special teams in basketball to me is their sideline outs and their baseline out of bounds and what we're going to run against theirs. And I'm very, very particular about how we're going to guard their baseline out of bounds plays. I never want to get scored on a baseline out of bounds play. So, you know, all those little tricks where guys are slipping and this is what they want, we got to be able to stop that, you know. So, and then, of course, shooting. The first 20 minutes, this is where I don't know if any young coaches are going to listen to this, but this is where I guess I've changed and adapted. I was a guy who, if I would have played music in practice about 6 years ago, I would have said, shoot me. I would have never, ever thought that music should ever be played in a gym. And about 6 or 7 years ago, I decided the first 20 or 25 minutes of practice when we do some skill work, which is not only shooting. We call it drift shooting. It's up and down. It's not traditional shooting. It's more shooting on the move where we're going to attack the paint and kick, and you have a partner and you've got some goals. You're taking on the other side of the gym. These are like one-minute drills, and there's a bunch of them. And then there's also some footwork drills, how to come up and get into a turf battle off your pivot, how to attack a ball screen on a hang dribble, blah, 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 blah. I'm not going to get into all that. But while we're doing that stuff, I figured, you know what, let the guys choose a playlist and just listen to some music because it kind of makes it fun. So we do for the first 20 minutes of almost every practice, we do stuff like that.
I got to believe that helps with the energy. Getting kids coming on the practice floor after school, yeah, and just kind of, yeah, getting things going. I would think that would be a huge benefit. And I can certainly see where your resistance to that would be, just in terms of you got loud music playing, then obviously you're not able to be very vocal in terms of players being able to hear you. So you got to trust that your guys are doing the things that you want them to do. But I'm sure it gets the energy level up.
Yeah, I've come to like it, and sometimes my managers will have fun with it, and they'll play a couple songs that they know I like. I'm a karaoke guy. Probably when I was like 35, I decided to be bold and sing New York, New York, or whatever the heck it was. So my assistants will, you know, they'll play some songs to be funny sometimes. Like if the kids are running suicides or whatever, they'll play Chariots of Fire.
Nice.
You know what I mean? They'll have some fun with it. So it's kind of become, you know, something to lighten the mood a little bit.
That's cool. All right, I want to ask you about a couple of things that you said while you were kind of going through your practices. So first is, when you talk about charting, and we hear a lot of coaches today talking about charting different things, and you mentioned charting some of the sort of the intangibles that you're looking for, whether that's deflections or charges or, yeah, offensive rebounds, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I always think is a challenge for a coach, and I'm thinking of it more from my perspective now where I'm coaching like a youth team and it's me and maybe one other assistant.
Right.
And I've always kind of tried to say, okay, I'm going to, you know, implement this system where I'm going to keep score and I'm going to track these things. And after like 2 minutes, I'm like, I can't keep track of any of this.
Yeah.
I'm like, I cannot keep track of any of this.
Right.
It's a waste of my time because, yeah, then I'm just trying to keep score. And it's just,
yeah.
So just tell me a little bit about your process.
Okay.
In terms of how you score things and what the mechanics of that,
yeah,
look like,
yeah,
from how is the data collected to then,
right,
what do you do with the data once it's collected?
Okay. Well, that first of all, I'm exactly the same way. I hate to waste time doing that stuff. So my managers, they will score that game. And so if a kid gets an idea, okay, so it's a 10 minute chaotic game that's kind of typically it's JV versus varsity, but it could be white versus blue. It doesn't have to be JV versus varsity. And the managers will know. We'll call out identity. And so they will chart that in the middle. You know where the quarters are on the scoreboard? Yep. That's where the identities go. And then on the sides of the scoreboard, that's where the scores go, blue versus white. So the managers do that, and when it's over, we don't do anything with it. We either got our identities or we didn't during that drill. And then we either run or we don't run if we got the identities. So yeah, you're right. Now, the only time I do keep something charted is, again, I've always had incredible managers at Hoban. And maybe some years it's one kid, some years it's three kids. Dom Damasio was our last guy, and he's a phenomenal kid. I'd love to tell you about him sometime, but it's not for this podcast. But he won the Beacon Journal Courage Award. His mom fought cancer. His brother fought cancer. He's a phenomenal kid. But Dominic will keep – we do something called 50 and 5 during our shooting series. And he will he has a Google Doc of a running count on how kids are doing on that, because that does matter to me. If you can make 50 shots with one rebounder, so it's a partner rebounding the whole time and you're shooting the whole time, if you can make 50 threes in 5 minutes, to me, you're a green light shooter, which means, you know, when you're open, sling it. Now, we don't necessarily tell guys less than that not to shoot, but it does help me understand statistically who's the best shooters in the gym.
Yeah, I think tracking, that's something that has become a lot more prevalent, I would say, probably in the last 5 to 10 years. Think back prior to that, and even if you were working on shooting, which I think a lot of coaches probably at that time didn't spend nearly as much time working on the skill development side of it and the shooting, it was much more team-oriented stuff. But certainly, even if you were doing that, you weren't charting the way you hear so many coaches are doing it, where they're keeping track and they've got maybe it's a shooting ladder of, you know, this guy's number one, this guy's number 15, and we use right. that to determine who's going to get a chance to shoot. And obviously with analytics and everything that's coming into the game, the ability to be able to utilize statistics, and then you think about right. just what huddle has done and yeah. crossover before that, and just the ability to break down film. And we could probably right. do a whole podcast on how different it is. If somebody's a young 25-year-old coach, they have no idea what you used to go through at age 22 to try to watch film as a player, as a coach. It was just disastrous. Oh, yeah. So yeah. things have definitely changed in that respect. And then the other thing that I want to talk about that you mentioned when you were going through and talking about your practices is when you're thinking about special situations and making sure your kids are prepared for your opponent. So clearly you're going through and you're watching the opponent's film. You're trying to probably get out personally and at least see him one time, maybe in person if you can make that work.
Right.
How much of the knowledge that you have and your staff has, are you sharing with the players? One, to make sure that they understand the things that you want them to understand, but two, trying to avoid getting them overloaded. I think about myself as a player,
right.
and I always felt like, man, these scouting reports, like, I got enough problems trying to figure out what we're doing, let alone worrying about what this opponent's going to do and how this guy is. More like, I was more interested in, like, what does my guy do well that I'm going to guard?
Right.
And if I know that, then I can kind of figure out the other right. team stuff. So just how do you avoid overloading the players and yet still taking advantage of the things that give you an advantage as a coach?
Right. Well, number one, I think we probably do overload them sometimes. So I don't know, you know, that could be a sin that we commit that I'm trying to work on. And there's ways that I'm trying to, for instance, if you don't play man-to-man on base and out of bounds, you simplify your life a little bit. And there are some teams who, like the Akron U Zips, play that 1-3-1 where there's a guy over the ball, three guys kind of taken across the middle area. It's more or less a 1-3-1, and they play that on their zone out of on their baseline out of bounds D. You know, Walsh plays a 2-3 zone on their baseline out of bounds D. I mean, those are ways to kind of simplify it, right? That way you don't have to get ready for their 15 out of bounds plays. However, I do think that with anything we do, there's got to be detail and work and preparation. So I think the way that I maybe don't overload them is I don't do paper scouting reports, because I think paper scouting reports are useless, because I think reading a piece of paper doesn't help me be a better basketball player. I do all of ours on huddle. So we will come in and watch film before the game of all the clips that I just spoke of the stuff that we practiced the day before on how to guard. So we have chapel at 3 p.m. the day of a game. We then have our team meal, and then we come in and watch film. And I have clips ready of everything that we went over the last 2 days. So that's how I simplify it for them, because I think people are more visual learners than they are a piece of paper. And so then they can see the baseline out of bounds play. They can see the set that they're going to run. They can see the defense that they're going to run. And they can see some of those tendencies that those players might have. You know, he goes left and then pulls up, like you mentioned. And so we'll go some, you know, we'll try to get as much as that we can, but that'll overload them too.
How long is that film that you show them? How long does that last?
I've tried to keep that, you know, no more than, especially on a game night where you don't want to totally fatigue them mentally, maybe like 20 minutes, 15. Yeah. On a game night, we can't keep them there too long. Sometimes it'll be 10 minutes. So
how much film do you watch in preparation for an opponent?
too much. I mean,
okay, let me ask you this before you answer that.
5 to 10 hours per time. Right. I mean, maybe 20. I don't know, man. A lot. I watch too much.
All right. So let me ask you this. Let's go back 20 years ago.
Right.
Are you watching more film because it's now easier to watch film?
Yes.
And is the amount of time that you're spending watching the film the same, but you're just more efficient, getting more volume of film watched? Or how would you characterize the distinction between 20 years ago versus today?
Yeah. I mean, I think I use my time more wisely now because I'm not down on the faculty lounge trying to be best friends with everybody. I'm you know, and I don't care who likes me and who wants to go out and get a drink on Saturday or whatever, because I'm almost 50 years old. I just want to do a great job, you know, in the classroom, and I want to do a good job as I can to help our kids win. So I use my time more wisely. I mean, anytime I have any free time, I'm watching the film. But I will say this, I hate to admit it. I'm not an in-person scouter anymore. My ADHD kicks in, you know, I'll go get a hot dog, eat a Kit Kat, start talking to somebody. 10 people will know me on the way in. Somebody I had in class last year, you know, so-and-so's mom walks by and she's good looking. And then next thing you know, I miss half the game. So I need to be in front of that computer, and I love to get 4 to 5 game films, and I can rewind it and I can rewatch it, and I can learn everything about a team that way. So I just tend to do a better job with film.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, as you said, when you go to a game, inevitably you walk in and there's 10 people that know you and that sit down and want to talk to you, and you're not going to put the blinders on and be like, hey man, I'm not talking to you. I'm trying to watch the game. I mean, clearly you can send subtle messages that's what you're trying to do. But we all know there are lots of people that don't get those messages quite as clearly as we think we're sending them.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
I could totally relate to
I miss scouting though. I miss going out and doing that. It was fun, but you know, I have a family, and my last 3 of them are out of the house, and my last one's here. I just want to be home with them as much as I can. And I can at least be on a screen, but be 10 feet from them here at home. I don't know. I don't mind going out, and if I have the time, I will. But until last year, I was coaching CYO basketball for my youngsters. Now my kid's going to be a sophomore, so I may start going back out more, but I've been doing a lot of film.
You're out of that world. All right, yeah. So this will take me back to the parenting question that I had for you. And when you were talking before, you said how you're coaching your own kids in CYO, you're coaching your high school team, and clearly, as the head coach, you are completely wrapped up in the game. You're wrapped up in the outcome. You're wrapped up in everything because it reflects completely on you.
Yeah.
When you sit in the stands, and maybe it wasn't basketball, but maybe it's watching your kids play another sport, what is your experience like as a sports parent who is not a coach when you're just when you're just sitting in the stands? What does that look and feel like for you compared to when you're coaching your own kids? Yeah.
That's a great question, and I hope if anybody, I hope somebody might listen to this episode because I've grown so much as a parent of athletes. Because my oldest daughter was female athlete of the year at Hope, and she was a pretty good athlete, and she played basketball, soccer, and track. And I would say, especially in basketball, I allowed myself to get sucked in a little bit too much. I never bothered anybody with the information, but I got sucked in. I was negative with her if she didn't play well, in a way. I mean, I wasn't overly negative with her, but I could be negative. Let's just put it that way. And maybe I saw her too much as a reflection of myself, and that wasn't really fair to her in a way. We didn't have a lot of asinine negative experiences as far as the way her and I communicated or anything like that. I'm not trying to say I was an idiot parent. I wasn't. But I think I got sucked in, and I didn't enjoy it as much as I should have. And then as it went down the rungs to my third, who was also a daughter, we finally just got to the point where we didn't care at all. I mean, I didn't care if my third daughter even played. if she got into the game, we were like, hey, Abby's in. This is great.
Right, exactly.
My wife would tell me, hey, Abby's in. You know, because she wasn't expected to be as good. But because she had less pressure, she just always played pretty well. And she was a little shooter who just kind of came off the bench. But when you get to that level where you're just there to enjoy your kids, it's so much more enjoyable for everybody. She was kind of a scrub who came off the bench, pretty much like her dad, but she shot it well. She actually has the school record for most threes in a game. She made 8 in a game one time, which is
pretty hilarious because
she wasn't a stud athlete and just kind of played sometimes when they had leads. But she did end up helping them a couple times here and there. But the point of the matter there is I think we developed and grew as parents and had that distance with the third that I didn't have with the first one. And the first one still had a great experience. It's not like anything went wrong, but I wish I would have known that earlier and just backed off of her and let her have a great experience. Now, I do feel bad for my son because, you know, being a coach's kid, we've never played daddy ball, and I've always been hardest on him. One of my goals is to not make his experience miserable. I don't want to be unfairly hard on him because he's already not going to be in the top rung of, you know, he's not a number 1, 2, or 3 guy on a team. You know, he's going to be a role guy. He knows basketball extremely well. He shoots it pretty well, but we also know his limitations, but I don't need to keep telling him his limitations every day. Because he kind of already knows.
Right, he understands. Them, right?
It's like,
I got
how many times do you tell your kid, you know, you're slow and you can't move laterally? I mean, after a while, you know, is that going to help him?
It's like, hey, I got that, Dad.
Yeah,
I got that.
Yeah. So I do want this one to go well. I want to be hard on him, and we get each other, and he loves basketball. I mean, he does work at it every day, but he's not, you know, physically going to go dunk the basketball or anybody, and he's not going to run the 100 in 9 seconds or anything like that. So I hope I can make it a positive experience for him to be a part of the team and enjoy giving back as a leader. So
yeah, that perspective I think is so important. I think it's one of the things that, as you said, you learn and grow as a parent. And I think you have ideas before your kids are born about what you think they're going to be and who you think you're going to be, who you think they're going to be and how you think you're going to raise them. And you realize as you go on that certainly your kids, and I'm sure my kids, have gotten far more exposure to basketball just because of who we are than a normal kid. But I found, again, you can't force a kid to like anything. Either they like it or they don't. They get exposed to it and then they make a decision about whether they want to pursue it, whether they're passionate about it. And I think you grow in that experience. And I think it's a challenge as a parent, especially if you're someone who is competitive and who had a passion for a certain thing. It's hard sometimes to not try to instill that same passion in your kids when their passion may lie elsewhere. And one of the things that I found to be very interesting for me is when I'm coaching, even I go back to coaching all my kids at very young ages, 3rd and 4th grade, and we'd play in a travel game or an AAU game and we'd lose. And I would be like, until the next game came, I would be distraught, just, you know, trying to figure out what can we do differently? And, you know, forgetting that they're 8 years old and, you know, what did I do wrong? And how come we can't figure this out? And
it would literally
like chew me up and I would think about it and all these things.
Oh yeah.
And then when my son started playing in middle school, and I obviously wasn't his coach during that time, and he would play, and I mean, I would just sit in the stands and I wanted him to do well. I wanted his team to win.
Yeah.
But literally that game would end and 5 minutes later, I could care less what the outcome was. I didn't think about it again. I didn't go back in my head and replay this or that or whatever. And so it was a very liberating feeling for me. And I think it helped me too.
Absolutely.
To have a better perspective as a coach is just, you know what? And like you said, something that stuck with me too is that you think that everybody's thinking about it. And the reality is nobody's thinking about it. You're the only person as the coach. There's no parent that's going home and reliving the 3rd grade basketball game and saying, oh, if only coach would have done this or done that, we could have had this happen. And it's just an interesting perspective that you gain, I think, over time. And it's something that I'm guessing all parents go through.
Yeah. It's sometimes I just think of if I get out of coaching, in a way, how nice it would be to get away from that pressure of being possessed by the game.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
You know what I mean? Because it is, you're right. When I just go to a game that I don't care about, I just leave and go home. I don't even think about it. But if you're the coach of that game, you might not even sleep that night. You know, and it's two different perspectives. So I have to be careful. I think all coaches do, to not let it, you know, impact the rest of your life, your health, and it, you know. But it's hard when you care about it.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about that the fact that you're so invested in it, and we can tell from just talking to you tonight how much time you're putting into it. When you put that much time into something, there's no way that you can step away and say, I'm just going to drop this and, you know, completely not think about it when I'm not there. It just becomes something that becomes critically important to you, if for no other reason than the time. And we know there's a lot more reasons why you do it than just the time and trying to win games. There's a whole lot more to it than that. Let's shift gears for a second and talk about your podcast. Tell me a little bit about why you decided to do it, what's been fun about it, and maybe some things that you've kind of learned along the way that you've taken from it that were surprising to you that maybe you didn't think about before you started your pod.
Yeah, that's a great question. I first of all, it was coronavirus and we were stuck at home, and I like to go. I don't run too much anymore. I do play tennis, so if I'm playing tennis, I'll run. But if it's singles, but otherwise, I'll walk. I'm a walker and a hiker now, with an occasional run in between. But and I love a couple podcasts. You know, yours was one of them. The basketball podcast from Chris Oliver, the Dan Dockich one. I mean, I've got a bunch of them that I listen to, and I just thought to myself, I really miss creating in the classroom. You know, teaching English has kind of become my passion. In addition to coaching basketball, and I just really enjoy the classroom experience. But I feel like when you're teaching a class, you're kind of creating content every day that's not there until you show up, in a way. Because I always, you know, I might differ from the lesson plan, or I might deviate from it and just make up something new every day. And that relationship with the classroom, you learn a lot from kids. And so I guess maybe I was missing that, and I just decided, you know what, we should do our own. So I called Scott Callahan, who was our girls coach at Hoban for 10 years. He's a phenomenal coach. He and I coached our sons in AAU from 3rd through 8th grade, and his boy Solomon had a great season at Wadsworth last year as a freshman. He was always one of our better players on our AAU team called the Gurus of Go. And Scott said, yeah, I'm in. Let's do it. So we started, and it's been a great experience. I can't imagine. I would never have guessed how much I would have learned from it. From the hockey club coach at Akron U was just a really interesting guy. Dave Pilipovich, the Air Force Academy head coach, was somebody that I think I respect to a man more than maybe anybody. What he did at the Air Force Academy with how difficult it is to recruit to there and the rules that they live under, I can't believe he got fired. I'm still sick about that. Because, I mean, you go 18-14 in that league with the kind of students that you have to get at Air Force. I mean, if you've ever had an allergy or a broken bone, you can't go there. You know, it's like that right there knocks out half the guys. You know,
right, for then, sure, especially nowadays.
Yeah, and then he was raised above a bar in PA. I mean, everything about his story, I just really appreciated. And he had recruited one of my players. You know, every episode is kind of interesting. You know, Scott got out of coaching for a year, and our first episode is talking about that. And you know, people say to get out of coaching to spend more time with your family, but you end up not spending more time with your family, or perhaps you miss what made you feel like you were alive. And Scott feels alive when he's coaching, so he's going to be back in it this year at Wadsworth. So that was cool. Jackie Wynn, and so many great. Every episode in and of itself was fun to be a part of. Tom Heil, who I coached, Dan DeCrane, you know, guys that I coached that we reconnected with. Dave Close is phenomenal. Just had him on. Ralph Orsini. So we've had 36 episodes, and the only thing that stinks right now is I don't have time to do them unless I do them late at night, and we're pretty worn down right now, so I want to get back in the flow.
Yeah, wait, you don't have time? You don't have time through all this learning virtually? And come on, man.
Yeah, we definitely have. We have embraced the late nights in terms of podcasting, and I can definitely relate to what you just said in terms of one of the things that I miss the most about stepping away from high school coaching, which I did now. It's probably been more than 10 years, which is incredible to me. But the thing that I miss more than anything is just the conversations that you have in the coach's office after practice, before a game, after a game, where it's just you and your friends sitting there and talking, yeah. whether you're talking through the game that just happened or whether you're talking about college basketball, or you're talking NBA, or you're just talking about life. And those are the conversations that that's probably the thing that I missed the most when I first stepped away. And in yeah. all honesty, the podcast has replaced that in not the same way, but right. you've gotten an opportunity to talk to so many different people at so many different levels of the game that have so many different ways of looking at things and approaching it. And it always makes me, I come out of every episode thinking about something that somebody said that is going to stick with me in whatever it might be. It might be in my coaching life. It might just be in my regular life. It might just be something that I sock away that I could put to use at some point. Right. Like I can already tell you right now, the thing that's going to stick with me from our episode right now is the Dave Jamerson, "You're a million shots behind." Like I'm already, I can already picture like 25 scenarios where I'm going to use that line with people already. So I mean, that's a line. Plus I have a personal connection to it.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, that's one that's going to stick with me. And I'm sure
I've used it a lot.
I believe it. I'm sure you have. And it's just, you know, you can see there's just tremendous value in it for the podcaster. And I feel right. like, sure, the person who's coming on and the guest, it's all about them. But I feel like I get as much out of it as hopefully as the guest does. And it's just a blast. And I'm glad that, you know, you've had an opportunity to get yours, you know, to get yours started. And it's something that, like you said, it's kind of like coaching in a lot of ways that
right.
people don't necessarily understand the amount of time that it takes to
right.
put it all together and make it sound good and
yeah.
kind of get yourself prepared for the interview so that you're walking in and have
right.
some idea of what you're talking about as you go into it. And
yeah.
you get better too. I know Jason and I have gone back and listen to some of our first episodes and you're just cringing going, oh my God, we were so terrible.
Right.
And you learn to improve. It's just like anything. You
yeah.
work at your craft and you try to get better at it. So
absolutely. Yeah.
It's been a lot of fun.
It was pretty neat. You know, it took me like a 2-week rabbit hole to figure out how to do the whole thing. But I will say when that podcast popped up on, you know, Spotify or iTunes, wherever I got it from. And it felt like I had achieved something. Even though we only had one or two episodes, but, you know, when your little symbol pops up on there.
Right. It's very cool.
And when you get to episode 363, you've got it all figured out. I promise you. That's
is that where you guys are now?
Yeah, this is 363.
Oh, my gosh, man.
Last night was 363, so.
Yeah, so it's actually more than that. We're probably about 4 or 5 ahead of that.
Man.
So, yeah.
I got to play the pick 3 then. Let me know what my number is, guys.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. I want to wrap up. We're getting close to our time limit here. I want to ask you just one final question, a two-parter, and it's one that I've kind of been going to as my last question for the podcast in the last couple episodes, because I think it gets out. It's kind of the heart of what a coach is all about. So tell me, one, what's the biggest challenge that you see going forward at Hoban? And then two, what's the biggest joy? The one thing that when you get out of the morning, the one thing about being a coach that excites you more than anything else?
Ooh, that's a good one. What was the first question?
First part was your biggest challenge.
Yeah,
second part,
yeah.
your biggest joy.
I think to me, the biggest challenge at a Catholic school, at a private school, is I don't want to circumvent the rules to be good. I don't want to take 17 transfers to be good. I don't want to go to AAU games and recruit your son to be good at Hoban. I just want to do it the right way and try to be good. And that doesn't really happen that often. And so I want to continue to be really good and have a program that can challenge the best teams. But I want to do it in a way, you know, that mixes, I guess, integrity with kids wanting to come to Hoban because they think it's a good program. So I don't want kids not to come to Hoban. I mean, that are good basketball players, but I want to do it the right way. So I think the challenge is moving forward, can you have a team that can win a state championship, or can you have a team that's going to have a great year where you can develop them through the process of the 4 years and not necessarily just take kids who come in? Because I don't know if that's winning to me. And then the second question is, what was the second question, Mike?
Biggest joy.
There's so many little joys all added up. I mean, you know, the obvious joy is the relationships with the kids and when they kind of come back and appreciate you or come back to a game or connect with you or ask you a question. You know, a lot of it is, I guess, one joy is when a kid asks you for, I don't want to say a favor, but maybe like a life moment, they give you a call. and they want your advice. To me, that's the greatest compliment anybody could ever give me as a teacher or a coach, is kind of wanting to pick my brain about something, because you feel like, oh, okay, I must be somebody that they can trust. That's a good feeling. So that's one. You know, in a basketball sense, I guess a huge joy to me is when you can make a bunch of kids feel a part of it. And you don't always achieve that, by the way. But there's those certain nights where everybody is so excited after a game and they didn't play. Or you could tell even after the season, they thought this was a good experience at the banquet. Like, if you can find a way to make everybody feel a part of it, even when they don't necessarily achieve the I don't want to say the selfish role, but maybe the individual glamour that they wanted to, that's like a huge joy. And those moments are rare, because typically you don't achieve that. But when you do, man, that's really special. And then, you know, the big one is I love beating somebody that you're not supposed to beat. I hope we can, again, you don't get that too often either. But when you get those nights when you beat somebody you're not supposed to beat, that's a really good feeling.
Yeah, I agree with you there. That's a huge thing. I've always said that, to me, one of the hallmarks of really good coaches is they beat the teams that they're supposed to beat, and then they beat some of the teams that they're not supposed to beat. And I think if you do that year in and year out, you're going to have a pretty successful career. And then if you can combine that with what you just said of having an impact on kids, that they want to call you up and share things that went on in their life, and they do feel a part of it, even if they maybe weren't the leading scorer, or even if they weren't a starter, or maybe they're a kid who doesn't even play.
Right.
That really is what coaching is all about. And clearly X's and O's and wins and losses are important. We all spend a lot of time on that.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, our success, you have to win some games in order to be able to have that other impact. The two go hand in hand, because if you don't win,
right,
you can't really have an impact when you're not, when you don't have a job.
Yeah.
So there's certainly that. But right. I think then when you get beyond that, then I think all of us, you know, want to realize that there's a bigger picture here. And I think as a teacher,
right,
you see that same thing, that you want to be able to have an impact in the classroom. You want to be able to have an impact on the court. And when you do that,
right,
that's when you're winning. And
yeah, absolutely.
That's really to me what it's all about. So
absolutely.
TK, I cannot thank you enough for spending some time with us tonight. Before we go, I want you to share how people can find out more about you and your program, share where they can find the podcast, and just tell them a little bit about where they can get more information about all the great things that you're doing down at Hoban.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Hoban.org is the Hoban website, Hoban.org. I don't know if anybody has kids in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade that are interested in Hoban, but they have to work through Sarah Handy, our admissions director, or a new lady who just joined us named Cheryl. You can find them on the website. But more importantly, if you want to email me about anything regarding teaching English or coaching or just youth basketball stuff, because God knows I've tried everything in youth basketball, griffitht@hoban.org is my email, griffitht@hoban.org. And then our podcast is called The Teacher Coach Podcast with TK Griffith and Scott Callahan, and we're on all the podcast apps. The Teacher Coach Podcast with TK Griffith and Scott Matthew Callahan. Thanks for asking me.
Absolutely. So definitely when you're done listening to our episode, make sure you get over and check out TK and Scott's podcast. They do a great job with what they're doing, and I know they're building it. And as you heard tonight, TK is looking for more time to get that thing up and going and continue to build it. And I know, as we talked about tonight, it's a lot of fun. So again, TK, can't thank you enough for spending some time, taking it out of your schedule to jump on the Hoopheads pod with us. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. If you have an existing podcast or are looking to launch your own pod but aren't sure where to start, the team at My Podcast Manager can help. Our podcast team works behind the scenes so you can do what you do best. We'll help you launch your podcast, make it sound great, and free up your time for the more enjoyable parts of podcasting. If you're ready to put your podcast editing, production, and promotion on autopilot with a trusted team of podcasting professionals, visit mypodcastmanager.com. to get started.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.